Penguin Random House Canada presents Red X by David Demchuk. Read for you by the author and Salvatore Antonio.
Carrigan Gu Shiordi. The city of Toronto, once the town of York, is nestled against the Great Lake Ontario, ensnared in an intricate web of rivers, creeks, and streams, valleys, and ravines, a wildness woven into its heart that the burgeoning metropolis has struggled to suppress, reshape, contain, and control over the last 200 years. Established in 1793 as a British colonial outpost under King George III, York was built on the traditional lands of the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and the Huron-Wendat, and was then known as Tukaronto, where the trees stand in the water, the gathering place. Now Canada's largest city, Toronto has survived battles and rebellions and riots, two great fires, two massive blackouts, earthquakes, a hurricane, and outbreaks of cholera, typhus, Spanish flu, HIV/AIDS, SARS, and more. Even so, thousands arrive each year from across the country in pursuit of education, employment, community, and belonging. Waves of immigrants and refugees from around the world have made its neighborhoods their home. At the southern edge of the city are the waterfront and the portlands, including Cherry Beach, built on land reclaimed from the lake and the marshland and from the delta of the Don River. To the north is Old Toronto, which includes the quaintly cobblestoned Distillery District, Corktown, and the St. Lawrence Market. To the west of Old Toronto is the downtown core, the old and new city halls, and the financial district, built over what had been the poorest area of the city, formerly known as the Ward. North of Corktown is the Garden District, which includes the inner city neighborhoods of Regent Park and Cabbage Town, their crumbling rooming houses, squat brick tenements, and squalid high-rises now falling prey to developers and speculators. The Garden District is home to Allen Gardens, a central park whose principal feature is an ornate Edwardian conservatory. Its predecessor, an Orientalist pavilion that notably hosted a lecture by a young Oscar Wilde, burned to the ground in 1902. Like Corktown, Cabbage Town was once inhabited by poor Irish immigrants who worked in the distilleries and is so named for the cabbages they reputedly grew in the front yards of their row houses and cottages. North of the Garden District and west of Allen Gardens is Toronto's Gay Village, a hodgepodge of bars, clubs, bathhouses and pubs, small shops and restaurants clustered around the intersection of Church and Wellesley. All the churches are on Queen Street, and all the queens are on Church Street, as the old saying goes. From there, the city stretches out in all directions. Impressed by its tidiness, efficiency, elegance, and modernity, the late Sir Peter Ustinov famously referred to the Toronto of 1987 as New York run by the Swiss. Much of that has changed in recent years, and sadly not for the better. The city was once a bastion of 19th-century Victorian morality, celebrated for imposing Christian values on its laws, citizens, and marketplace. Now its brittle veneer of propriety and conformity is belied by its treatment of its most vulnerable residents. The quaintly refined facade is eroding, the mask of civility slips and falls, littering the ground. Frequently derided as Toronto the Good, the center of the universe, the city resented by the rest of the nation for its hubris, arrogance, and vulgar ambition now strives to reconcile its prim provincial attitudes with its world-class aspirations and to accommodate the conflicting political, economic, and cultural values held by its substantial and disparate populace. Fearful of meaningful change and the demands it might place upon them, civic leaders routinely sabotage every improvement they propose, from increasing property taxes to expanding public transit to building affordable housing. Preening, soulless, authoritarian, insecure, its singular achievement remains its many cinematic impersonations of other greater cities. A chasm yawns between the wealthy and the disadvantaged, the privileged and the marginalized. One can see past its teeth to the back of its throat, more teeth, still more teeth, teeth all the way down. Public services have eroded. The infrastructure is crumbling. Violence and hate are on the rise. A trans woman killed, her body found in a ravine and left unidentified for months. A murdered young woman found in a stairwell, not by the police, but days later by her mother. 10 pedestrians killed and a dozen more injured by a van driver targeting women with his vehicle. 2 people killed and 13 others wounded by a mass shooter one summer Sunday. Cellars are seeping. Foundations are cracking. Rivers are overrunning their banks. What was once buried, pushed underground, is now erupting, bursting up and through. All around the city, past and present entwine like lazy lovers as the last light fades. Along streets and alleys, behind buildings and under bridges, the shadows deepen and darken. Whatever hungers within them cannot be contained.
1984. Sometime that August, a young man named Ryan Wilkes vanished without so much as a whisper. The city was radiant and shimmering in the late summer heat. A thin film of humidity adhered to the skin, attracting smog and grit and inviting midges and mosquitoes to a sticky demise on one's forearms. Ghostbusters dominated the movie screens, a transit strike was looming, the Pope was coming to visit, and Bananarama's Cruel Summer was climbing the dance charts. Ryan was in his mid-20s, sandy blonde, lightly freckled, not quite tall enough or old enough or beefy enough to escape the dreaded twink label. Newly in town from Windsor, Detroit's automotive sister city, with just a few months of metropolitan life under his belt, he mostly bussed tables at a few of the bars, hoping to save some money to enter the design program at the Ontario College of Art. He worked as a bar back at Boots, and also covered off a few times next door at Bud's, stepping in for someone sick or picking up a stray shift or two. He didn't have a steady boyfriend, didn't really date, didn't go to the baths or parks, and rarely to other bars. He was a loner, mostly, estranged from his family, with a flight attendant for a roommate and not many friends. Sometimes he'd have 4 or 5 days off between shifts while his roommate held 2 and 3 day layovers. As a result, it took until Tuesday the 28th for anyone to realize he hadn't been seen since the Friday before. Even then, people assumed he'd just gone back south, or gotten another job, at a straight bar maybe where he could make more money, or shacked up with somebody somewhere, or left for another city, Montreal or Vancouver, or even the States. His roommate wasn't necessarily surprised to see him go. The city may welcome you, but it might not invite you to stay. Still, it was confusing. His room, filled with all his belongings, offered no obvious clue. He wasn't a known drug user, and no illicit substances were found in his room, apart from a few mild sleeping pills he had borrowed from a friend. Suicide was a possibility, though he didn't seem the type. It was only when a garbage collector found a neatly folded stack of clothes in an alley behind a stretch of weary old sex shops and strip clubs and porn theaters, the clothes that Ryan was last seen wearing. Only then was his disappearance called into the police. But with no sign of struggle, no significant leads, and no mother or wife or girlfriend or family to place pressure on them, the investigation was half-hearted at best. Missing gay men weren't what you'd call a priority. The flight attendant roommate and some friends and co-workers printed up flyers and posted them around the village. Those lasted a few days before being torn down by street cleaners or papered over with photos of lost cats and dogs. The missing persons file languished, then dropped out of sight after just a few weeks. Late that autumn, on November 9, A Nightmare on Elm Street was released and made, as they say, a killing. The winter winds began to blow. The snow began to fall. White t-shirt, white jockstrap, Levi buttonfly cutoffs, wallet and cash and ID, and keys tucked in the pockets. Dirty sports socks, beaten down chucks, and a navy blue hanky neatly tucked into the left shoe. Ryan Wilkes, 24, of 85 Isabella Street, was never found. In the golden warmth of that August afternoon, in his sun-dappled den of a...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?